Hey everybody, this is Chuck Marone with Strong Towns. Welcome back to the Strong Towns podcast. A few weeks ago, I shared some thoughts on the platform formerly known as Twitter. I was in a conversation, or there was a conversation going on, and as happens on social media platforms from time to time, it was a little bit on the extreme side of the equation in terms of the banter going back and forth. And I recognize that we kind of lost the plot, right? This often happens when we're talking about things on social media platforms. In this instance, we were talking about traffic safety. And I made the comment that I think we need to actually step back and have some empathy for drivers. That in context, out of context, however you wanted to use it, inflamed a lot of people. The idea that we should empathize with drivers, and that actually the best way to fix streets and reform streets and build coalitions for people who are going to make significant change on the ground is that we start with empathy. To me, it was like a very obvious thing. To people in the online social media, formerly known as Twitter community, at least for some of them, this was quite inflammatory. I was contacted by someone on Twitter who went by the handle Bike Talk. And in fact, if you go to biketalk.org, you'll find a podcast going back many, many, many years about bike talk. It's talking about biking and biking related issues. They asked me if I would come on the podcast and chat about this idea of empathy. It's my understanding that Bike Talk is broadcast on the radio in the Los Angeles market. So quite a large audience, certainly a large podcast following. Biketalk.org is the online address. They gave me the audio and have allowed me to run it and share it with you. So this is my appearance on the Bike Talk podcast, talking about why we should have empathy and why leading with empathy is maybe a good idea. Thanks, everybody.
You are listening to the Strong Towns podcast.
So we have Charles Marone, who is the founder of Strong Towns and author of Confessions of a Recovering Engineer. Hi, Charles.
Hey, it's nice to be here.
I wanted to have you on because you quoted a tweet. Well, it was a funny thread. You ended up by saying we shouldn't be mocking this arms race of car size the way that we do on Twitter. And I thought that was interesting. So I wanted to talk about it. And I have here Stacey Rendecker.
Hi. So, nice to meet you, Chuck.
Very nice to meet you.
Do you want to start by talking about this tweet?
Yeah, I do a lot of tweets. So, but I do remember this engagement, this back and forth. I am kind of allergic to the war on cars notion and the idea that the way we look at traffic safety is a fight between people who are driving and people who are not driving. That somehow that is either a good and healthy framing for us as humans, that somehow that is a positive way to bring about change in our street designs and our safety profile and make things better. And that somehow it is a good way to do advocacy. I'm kind of allergic to all of that. And so Twitter is this space where people, you know, go back and forth. And if you can get a good zinger in, you can get a lot of likes. And I think it has kind of a self-reinforcing echo chamber. I like to take the opportunity now and then to signal to my followers, to signal to Strong Towns advocates that as you're out on the street, as you're out working with people, as you're out trying to get things done, not only is this not like a very helpful approach, but it's actually not a good mindset to have. Looking at your fellow humans as adversaries to be mocked at best and defeated and pounded into the ground at worst is just not a healthy way to live. And it's also not a healthy way to bring about change, particularly on this issue where 92% of Americans drive at least once a week, where, you know, outside of a handful of major metropolitan areas, that number goes up to 97, 98%, where 2 out of 3 vehicles that are sold every year is an SUV, where we essentially live in a culture where everyone is in a sense immersed to one degree or another in driving. When you have a national profile like that, and you lead with antagonism and a war on cars and a war on drivers, and these are the enemies, you tend to isolate yourself in a rhetorical bubble that not only doesn't lead to change, but actually leads to a lot of frustration and anger that I think is misdirected.
I get swept up in this anti-driver thing a lot, even though I drive every day. But this particular thread was about people having to buy bigger and bigger cars and saying that, you know, I need to do it to protect my family. And then it had these progressively bigger, first you need to buy a tank and then you need to buy this. I didn't know they had vehicles like that. These
land crawlers and
I was in the Army, and my job in the Army was actually a truck driver. So I drove some obscenely large things, and they were small compared to some of the other things that people drove. So yeah, the vehicles come in many, many sizes. A lot of them are massive.
And unfortunately, we are seeing them more and more on our city streets. And If the United States was blanketed with Fiat 500s and minis and smart cars, the death toll would be a lot lower. The injury count would be a lot lower. And I think a lot of the vitriol would be taken out of it. We have built a world where automobiles are required. Yes, I would love a world where you don't have to have cars at all, that transit is available in even the smallest and strongest of towns. But we don't have that. And since automobiles are required, we have a choice in the type of vehicle that we drive. But too often, the choices that are provided to us by the manufacturers, and then what is thrown off in this cycle of choice, it is an arms race. And I don't see the people who are trapped in this laying down their arms anytime soon. And thus, for us outside who are walking and biking, that's when war has been incited, because the body count is too high. And so, yeah, we fight.
I agree with much of that. Let me try to provide some nuance, because I think there's a lot of nuance that is warranted in this discussion. You made a statement at the top that was something along the lines of, if people drove smaller cars, the body count would be less. That's an interesting supposition. I don't know as I agree with it, by the way. From a physics standpoint, momentum is mass times velocity. If you have a lower mass car traveling at a higher velocity, you get the same, you know, in a sense, momentum.
You do understand the grille height as well. So the
I get that.
The small electric vehicle that is as heavy as a traditional truck is not going to hurt as much for most adults, because we will be propelled over the vehicle versus getting mowed under the vehicle, to the form factor.
Yep, I understand. And there certainly is a physics aspect to this. I'm not one who goes out and cites studies like, show me the study that does this and that. I think there's a lot more that we can learn from intuitive thinking. But in terms of studying crashes where people die, the height of the vehicle, the size of the vehicle, is something I think that both from the recipient's side, this whole thing started by a dad who said, don't put your kids in small cars, because here's what will happen if you do. My kids were in a big car and they survived this crash. I actually think that is somewhat spurious. I also think the other side of the equation, that somehow we have this mayhem of monster trucks driving through urban areas, running people over. That's not data supported either. What we do have is we do have people driving in auto-oriented environments that by their design signal to drivers that you own this space, you own this road. We have designed this for you. And that design, regardless of the driver, I mean, we see people who are, you know, quote unquote, very careful drivers. And that type of design licenses a certain amount of aggression or a certain amount of antisocial behavior. If you are someone walking and someone drives next to you at 30 miles an hour, which is the speed limit on most streets across North America, it will feel very violent. It will feel very challenging. It will feel like you are deeply, deeply threatened, even though that person is driving at speeds that are quote unquote legal on the roadway. I think that as people outside of vehicles, we tend to, I mean, we have a very different perspective than people who are driving. And I think part of getting people who are driving to understand that perspective, let me just say, we go in the opposite direction when we make it, in a sense, rivalrous. So I get where you're starting from and I get where you're coming from. And the idea that if we could somehow, you know, reduce the kinetics of a vehicle, that that would be safer. I actually don't think that would move the needle very much ultimately, but we could debate that. Let me give this analogy, because you said you would like to somehow stop this arms race. And I get that reaction. In economic development, there is a localist movement, and I consider myself a localist probably more than anything else. There's a localist movement that is all about buying local. If you're going to buy a hammer, don't go to Home Depot and buy it for $12. Go to the local department store and buy it for $15, because that increment that you'll spend more is good for local business. It's good for the economy. It's good for, you know, your community. Do the right thing. And I think there's something deeply moral in that, right? Like, I think that we can make that moral case that by making that $3 sacrifice on a hammer, we're way better off. Don't buy it on Amazon. Don't order it from Home Depot. Go get it at the local place. But the reality is that a change, as a change campaign, that tends to go nowhere. It tends to work for like the 1%, 2%, 3% of people who will buy into that. And the 97% of people who are just going about their lives, trying to exist, trying to make ends meet, it's not a very compelling argument. It's a compelling argument as humans. Like, it's like, yeah, I would like to do that. But in the moment, people need to save that $3 and they don't go buy the hammer from the local store. And we see this over and over and over again. That idea of shaming people into behavior that is against their own interest is really not a valid, like, long-term change strategy. Somehow we have to talk about that transaction in terms of the interest of the person. And I think we have to think about it in terms of the interest of the person. So the idea that, and I use my wife as an example, when we had a baby, I had a little Toyota Echo, a little tiny, tiny car. And I got in a car crash and actually totaled that car. And I was going to buy another one. I really liked that car. And my wife said, if you buy a tiny car, you're not taking the kids with you. Like, it's just not going to happen. And I wound up getting a kind of mini SUV. Is my wife's reaction wrong? Maybe we could argue about that. Is my wife's action, you know, reaction ill-informed? I don't know. I mean, she's a really intelligent person. Is my wife's reaction antisocial? Is it immoral? I think, you know, there's certainly an argument to be made from the bike walk activist kind of community that it is immoral. If all those things are true, would it change her behavior? Would it change her reaction? Would it change her thought? And I'm saying, I don't think it would. And so this, like, campaign of, again, shaming 92% of Americans, and even higher percentage outside of, like, major metropolitan areas, into doing behavior that is at its core not in their own personal interests, that may make us feel good. It might be a rallying cry for the 2%. It might be, you know, a way to get people to show up at meetings in San Francisco and shout people down. I don't know. As a broad change strategy, it is counterproductive. And it actually makes it much harder in a city like mine or a Tulsa or a Kansas City or a Cleveland. It makes it much, much harder to have these conversations and much, much harder to make change.
What's your city, Charles?
I live in Brainerd, Minnesota. So I'm live in a small town a couple hours north of Minneapolis, St. Paul.
You used the example of buying a more expensive hammer to buy local, but you could have chosen a lot of examples that we see in bike advocacy.
Go for it.
Like you should be able to ride a bike in winter and do your errands instead of driving a car.
Yeah. Yeah. And here in my hometown, it's really hard to bike in winter because when it snows, the very first thing that City Hall does is go out and clear snow off the major streets for the cars. They don't care about the side streets as much. They don't care about where people bike. They don't care about where people walk. Clearing the sidewalks is an individual thing. So property owners are supposed to clear their own sidewalk. And so I walk to work every day. It's six blocks. Probably 3/4 of that is cleared. And then 1/4 of it, people don't do anything and the city doesn't enforce it. We put a huge amount of emphasis on making sure people driving can get to where they want. I've talked to people at City Hall, like we've had this conversation and people recognize it. They've done more in recent years to like clear the park, which is a big walkway for people. But the reality is until we build a culture of biking and walking here in my town, the emphasis, you know, voters, people in the community are in a sense demanding that the roads be cleared first, because I don't think I'm exaggerating. 99% of trips in my community are done by vehicle. And so I can complain all I want. My walk probably gets a disproportionate amount of resources compared to what the overall demand is.
I hear you saying that shaming people into not driving or buying a smaller car if they do drive is going to have the opposite effect from what you want. So then the opposite of that would be empathy. And I think you also talk about empathy that a transportation planner has to have too. There's an article that's going to come out soon that you shared with me where you say that transportation planners should empathize and lament the fact that they design auto-dominated environments. So they have to empathize too.
Yeah, in that article, I said, someday in the future, there'll be a truth and reconciliation committee for traffic engineers. So we can, you know, have a reconciliation so we can, you know, have a purging of guilt in a sense from the system. I think it's important. What is often lost in this war on drivers and this war on cars and this kind of zero sum battle we have between people who are driving and people who are not driving is the idea that driving is actually really horrible. And the people who are doing it are largely stuck doing it. It's not often a choice. It is an obligation to own two cars, to spend your day commuting, to drive through a neighborhood, to take a long period of time to get places that used to be routine for people who lived 40, 50 years ago, is a huge burden on people. Coming up with car payments is a huge burden on people. And when you talk to people who are in crashes, whether it's a fatal traumatic crash or not, you will almost inevitably run into the idea that I was doing the behavior that I always do. In other words, I was going along like I normally go along and something random happened. And there, by the grace of God, I would have been killed or I would have been injured or someone else would have been, or this horrible thing happened. Driving in America is not like a fun activity. And I know automakers and commercials try to make it a fun activity and we nostalgize driving to some degree. And I will even acknowledge that being on the open road at times has like a feeling of liberation associated with it at times. But the vast majority of time that humans spend in cars is pure misery. It's not a great thing. It is especially urban driving, even more than rural driving, urban driving is a constant source of frustration because the environment is designed for you to go fast. You have wide lanes, you have shoulders, you have extra room, but yet you are trapped with all these vehicles around you that don't allow you to go fast. You have stop signals that make you go slow. And so if we get into the psyche of the humans, and again, these are humans who are driving. If we get into the psyche of the humans, you are put into a maze in a sense and given competing signals. Signal A is drive really fast. Signal B is don't you dare drive fast. Like we're going to clamp that down. And it's a very disorienting, frustrating thing. It would be as if we put someone at a dinner table and said, you know, you're very, very hungry. Here's a big swath of food. And then, oh, by the way, you get a tiny plate and you have to fill it up and then go back to your chair and then go back and fill it up and then go back to your chair and you don't get to take extra. And you would find people being human, which is they would get really ticked off. They would get really frustrated. And so I do think that we should empathize with the experience of the driver because we should recognize that 92% of humans are not like horrible, awful people, but a huge percentage of people, when they get behind the wheel, turn into horrible, awful people. Why is that? It's not because they enter the car immoral. It's not because they enter the car without empathy. It's not because they enter the car without caring about others or, you know, somehow like see someone walking and biking and don't recognize them as human. It's because the environment that we put them in is dehumanizing. It's dehumanizing. It is violent. It is aggressive. And that is something that we have done by choice. That's something that traffic engineers have done by choice. That's something that transportation planners have done by design. And the reality is that we can change that design. And it's really not that hard. It would actually cost us less money to design human places than inhuman places.
I agree with a good portion of that. I guess I just lament the fact that I live in San Francisco. We are a postage stamp of a place, 7 miles by 7 miles. It's really a glorified village, but it is the second most densely populated city in this country. And when I attend Vision Zero meetings, this goal that we set for our city to reach zero traffic deaths 10 years ago, and we have failed miserably. And I listen to the transportation planners and traffic engineers where we do have a solid municipal transit program where you could traverse every which way of this city in under an hour, even less with an e-bike, that we cannot limit cars, or we have to be worried about parking, or that cars must have access to every single street. If we can't do this in bikeable 365 days a year, beautiful California, where, how on earth will it happen in Brainerd? I don't understand how having empathy for people trapped, or unless you're talking about the reckoning and the truth commission or whatever for planners.
I said truth and reconciliation. Yeah.
Okay. Truth and reconciliation. So will that be similar to The Hague?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we need to have them come forth and in a sense, confess their sins. Like, I was part of this killing machine. I thought I was doing good. I wasn't. And when I recognized that I wasn't, I continued to work in this system and pretend things were okay. Yeah, I actually think we need to reach that point at some point. Yes.
So you're advocating for that. How does that happen? Because Secretary Pete rolled out, who I like and think is a brilliant guy, but he rolled out this safe systems approach or whatever 2 years ago, and he's celebrating like, oh, this quarter is down slightly in terms of the killing machine that is transportation in the US. It is. Yeah. I mean, it's like,
it's a non-serious approach.
Right. Asking for allies and commitments rather than using the power of his department to change the way things are done. If we can't get somebody who has traveled the world and speaks more languages than I can count, you know, to be able to affect change at that level, or to have this sort of, enlightenment about how on earth will it happen in town after town, in city after city.
So I hear what you're saying, and I wholeheartedly agree. Let me flip this around a little bit, because I feel like this is part of where we're stuck. Mayor Buttigieg is incredible. I went out and met Mayor Pete, and I chatted with Mayor Pete, and I saw what Mayor Pete did. I walked his town. I met his staff. They are well on their way to Vision Zero, and they're not doing it in a top-down kind of way. They're doing it in a very like organic bottom-up way in South Bend. South Bend is one of the country's greatest success stories. And if you would have told me 4 years ago that Mayor Pete would become Secretary Pete, the Secretary of Transportation, I would have said this would be a glorious day for transportation in this country. The reality is We have done what we always do, or what we've done for the last 80 years in terms of transportation spending, is we did marketing to advocates around reconnecting communities and Vision Zero and building safe streets. And we spent, you know, pennies on that. And then we spent multiple dollars on highway expansions and big roads and all that. If you look where we, you know, you are where you spend your money, like you can talk whatever values you want, but where do you spend your money? And this administration, from the, you know, the president on down, has put a huge emphasis on highway expansions, on automobile commuting, on cutting congestion. And these are not the priorities they speak about. These are not the priorities they, in a sense, market the package with and surround the package with. But these are the things that, from a top-down standpoint, get the funding. So when you look at San Francisco and you say, why is San Francisco, why are the leadership here who all talk a good talk, why can't we make this change here? And I'll just point out that California is the epicenter of North American conversation about climate change. You got something like $75 million, like targeted money for climate change. And you took half of that, which the infrastructure bill allowed you to do, and you spent it on highway expansions. The opposite of climate change. You literally spent it on the opposite of climate change. When you have that as the top-down culture, like we can say one thing, but here's where our money goes. It is really, I think, easily understandable that in City Hall, where they orient vertically, where they're all about, we're the implementation arm of state and federal policy, City Hall, in a sense, is wired to carry out the bidding of, you know, state policymakers and federal policymakers, which is about moving cars. At Strong Towns, we talk a lot about City Halls needing to reorient and to reorient horizontally. So instead of making ourselves into the algae in a food chain of governments, like local governments, the lowest level of government, we're actually the highest level of coordination of people living in a community. And when you have a city hall that orients horizontally, like Mayor Pete's did in South Bend, what you see is that the best financial investments that we can make are biking and walking. The kind of investments that people are demanding in our streets are biking and walking. You can cut costs by narrowing streets and replacing that with turf and trees, and you actually get nicer neighborhoods that people want to live in. You can do things like create local businesses and local destinations and corner stores, redoing your zoning, changing the way you build housing. You can do all these things, and they're immensely popular in a bottom-up way. In a top-down way, they're the marketing brochure. In the bottom-up way, they're reality. And I think there's nothing more than Vision Zero that kind of, you know, is emblematic of this. Vision Zero, I think it's zero vision. Vision Zero is all about three things. It's about education, enforcement, and engineering. Okay. Education is, we're going to put up a billboard to tell people to be aware when they're driving. It is the most cognitive dissonance you have on what the experience of being a driver is. I like to describe it as an anti-obesity campaign where you put, you know, warning labels in the bathroom, but then went in the break room and filled it full of salty snacks for free. It's like you're not understanding human behavior. And all of the education stuff in Vision Zero is, to me, like guilt letting. We're going to put up this sign and have us feel good about ourselves as a state DOT or as a local official. And anyone who has studied anything about human psychology will tell you this makes zero difference. It has no impact at all. The second part of it is enforcement. And what we see is that money goes to state highway patrol, money goes to local police departments, and they use it on overtime to do traffic stings and all kinds of stuff that has no relation to traffic, but is really wildly popular because it allows police departments, you know, at every level to kind of fund themselves a little bit more, which is good if you're in City Hall. Not effective for transportation safety, very effective for, in a sense, like pork barrel, right? The third part is engineering. And you would think that this is the place where we're actually going out and making streets safer. This is the place where we're actually going out and making substantive changes. But if you study the projects that get done under the Vision Zero banner, it's not a lot of money. So it tends to be a little bit here and a little bit there around freeing up places from congestion. So widening lanes, widening out intersections. It tends to have a lot of like the veneer of safety. So we will build this new strode, but we'll put a bike lane down the side. You know, as if somehow that anesthetizes all the other danger that you've created with 40, 45 mile an hour traffic and all this complexity. I actually think that the common ground that we have between driver, cyclist, walker, you know, city hall, the common ground we have is that when we focus bottom up, we can actually make great investments that build wonderful places much, much cheaper than when we go after the state money and the federal money and try to play that game and fall within that rubric. We lose control, we lose the narrative. And I think if you're very, very cynical, which I can be sometimes on this, I think that some of these top-down systems actually have a little bit of satisfaction when we fight each other. I actually think like that's part of the, it's part of what gives, I think, some of these top-down systems a bit of strength, because right now in these traffic safety community, there's a huge push amongst people. And this came out in the thread that I was on Twitter. There's a huge push amongst people that the answer to this problem is to get the National Highway Transportation Safety Board to regulate the size of vehicles. Like if we just empower them to wield a cudgel on the auto industry and the consumer, that somehow like this will work itself out. And I think we have given up too much power. I actually think we have way more power and way more authority than we think. And I want to see cities, local governments orient around the needs of people in their community and use a big expanded toolbox to do beautiful, wonderful things that would include making streets way safer for everybody. That's my anti-top-down rant.
Okay. You had me on 95% there, cheering in the background as you're going down the list. How do I get my city to take that pill, the South Bend pill or whatever, that understands what we actually have to do, how we have to orient our streets, whatever? It was great. I loved it. And it reminds me of what I wanted to ask you about. Mm-hmm. I'm very focused on climate and how we are failing, how the United States is the problem, how our automotive oil-based nation is really causing things on a global scale. And then the intersection with, we feel it every day in our towns and our cities. I don't think that there is any one thing that can solve climate change. I don't think that there is any one thing that is the magic bullet for Vision Zero or just having a better functioning, healthier way of moving, less dangerous way. But it is a multitude of things, and we must have all of them working. So to say that NHTSA won't solve it, vehicle size alone is not the answer. We certainly had mounting traffic deaths before these bloated land crawler mobiles and whatever. Yeah. The safest car when I was growing up was a Volvo. That's what you put your family in. And at that time, Volvo didn't have anything that stood over the height of an average adult. They were all sedans, and they were absolutely the safest cars on the road. So the idea that you have to have this ever escalating obese mobile, mm-hmm. I do think that that's an issue.
Our peer nations don't have the same kind of traffic deaths that we have. And we have a different relationship to regulation. And like you see it with guns. I mean, isn't there a pretty strong argument for how regulation does affect traffic deaths?
See, I feel like we have way more regulation in a lot of ways. If you go to, you know, Western Europe and you look around, you don't see very many large vehicles. And you're like, well, okay, well, these people are smarter, more civilized, more decent, more moral. You could ascribe all those things if you wanted. I think the more practical reason is that it would be dumb to drive a big car because the streets are narrow and you can't drive fast. And if you have a big car, there's no place to park it and you can't get around. if you come over here and you look and you say, why don't people drive small cars? Well, we have spent 80 years widening streets, widening, like, providing parking spaces, obsessing about commuters, denuding our neighborhoods in order to accommodate really, really large vehicles. And, you know, efficient economies. So efficient economies mean putting stuff on big trucks and hauling it around. When you do that, there's a certain defensive mission creep that happens within every household that allows these kind of larger trucks to become the not just accommodated, but then once it's accommodated, like the preferred option. That's not really a regulatory thing at all. I mean, Europe has not mandated narrow streets. They have a different design ethic. They have a different design approach. They build their cities differently. You know, we have a lot of regulations on how you must build a street. We have a lot of regulations on how you must design something. And it forces us to go in the wrong direction. I actually think if we got rid of a lot of those, our local engineers, our local transportation officials would find it much easier to do their job. So many of them will say, you know, and I think this was part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a concept. So many of them will say, well, I was just following the rules. I was just following the standards as they were laid out for me. I was just following what everybody else did. I was just copying the last engineer who did this. And a lot of that institutional inertia is what keeps us from doing, I think, things that would have a bigger impact more quickly.
But, oh my gosh, I'm so glad I get to ask you this.
Yeah.
Why do they do it? Why do they follow something that is so broken? Why are we still hiring or requiring, you know, education or certification for transportation planners? Because it's all wrong. And so if this is the test you've been trained to, this is what we're getting in our cities. And I argue that, you know, we advocates, we could build a much more effective transportation system than the ones who've gone to school for it.
Yes.
Why don't they do it differently?
Well, I wrote a whole book about this. Confessions of a Recovering Engineer is designed to say, like, here's how it's all wrong and here's why we've done it wrong and here's how we do it differently. And so, yeah, there's a large institutional problem. I think if we understand engineers, and this is why I think Truth and Reconciliation Commission, as opposed to, you know, literally the Hague, where we take people out and hang them for their war crimes, you know, South Africa is a better model. It's like, let's come forth and talk about the bad things we did so that we can forgive each other and move on. But let's face it, let's be honest about it. The reality is that the traffic engineering profession, the modern one, inherited standards that were developed right after World War II to build interstates across North America. And if you go back to that period of time and you are generous to the people who were there, which I think we should always be generous to people of the past, because we are very flawed humans like they were, they were trying really hard to stay out of a second Great Depression. You know, they ended this war, they demobilized all these troops, they shut down all these industries. And by all accounts, every economist thought, we're just going to go right back into the depths of the Depression. And instead, what we did is we embarked on this massive building movement to build interstates, build frontage roads, build interchanges, create suburbs, build housing, fill that housing full of consumer goods. We created an economy based around cities that would grow. And engineers and planners, quite frankly, but traffic engineers in specific, spent that time learning how to do that well. And they embodied that as kind of like the commandments they received on stone tablets. Like, this is the gospel according to the people who originated this. Remember, the engineering profession is thousands of years old. The traffic engineering profession is like 2.5 generations old. I mean, it's really, really young. The body of knowledge, the wisdom that is very, very young wisdom. But it is treated as if it was given to us by Moses. It's like, here's the book. Here's what you follow. You add into that a certain amount of power that is ingrained in having a set of standards that you can apply. And then you add into that the fact that lots and lots of money allows us to be stupid for a long period of time. In other words, if you can overcome all of your problems by getting another federal appropriation, another state appropriation, another bond issue that you float, you know, another assessment that you do, you don't have to actually reconcile with the impacts of your stuff if you have lots and lots of money flowing through. And every time our economy sputters, every time we have difficulty, what do? We pour more money into transportation, more money into infrastructure, and we allow these professions to not adapt, to basically continue to be dumb. I wish that the traffic engineering profession had run out of money 40 years ago. Because if they had, we would have beautiful highways, we'd have beautiful local streets, and we could afford to maintain them, and we'd have great places. It's the fact that we could continue to fund stupidity over and over and over again, and that we did at like huge volumes of cash, that has allowed it to persist as long as it has.
Yeah, because when I look at the proposed budgets for making streets safer, or how much they say it takes to retime an intersection or get new traffic lights and whatever. And I'm like, how on earth can it cost that much?
I'll go out and do it myself tomorrow. Right.
You know, yeah. Well, one, build roundabouts. Yeah. Why are we insisting upon signalized intersections or instructing drivers that they will wait at stop signs? You know what I mean? And they, and yeah, yes, totally it might not be as efficient, but it will ideally be safer. Oh my gosh. So many things
change
in our built environment. Yes. And they won't do the simplest of them.
I think it's very instructive to go to poorer parts of the world. I've not been to a lot of them, but I have been to, you know, parts of Southern Italy that are very, very poor. I've been to parts of Greece that are very, very poor. And you look at how they do these things, and it is less glamorous than what we do, certainly. I think American sensibilities would be offended if I said we should strive to be Southern Italy, right? But the reality is that from a functional standpoint, these places function a lot better. Because they have gotten to the phase where they hack things. They're like, you know, we don't have any money, so we got to make this work. How do we hack it?
What's an example of that?
You said roundabout. Mm-hmm. Intersections where you just get rid of the traffic signal because it's dumb, and you put like a planter in the middle, and people just drive slow.
Okay. Yeah.
You're coming into the intersection. It kind of narrows down a little bit, and then you just drive slow, and you don't hit it. You try not to hit people. I've seen a lot of crashes in place like this. Southern Italy is kind of a madhouse for drivers, but it's a madhouse at low speeds where crashes mean like you dented your door, not you ran over someone and they're under your bumper.
And how large are those vehicles?
No, they're tiny, but they're tiny, but they're tiny. And understand what I'm saying about large vehicles. I'm not suggesting that large vehicles are not a problem. I think we obsess over it. And I think there's a certain, I'm going to say like culture war, and culture war like came up in the tweet thread. There's a certain culture war aspect of the SUV driver that I think is unhealthy for us as discourse. But the reason why there's small vehicles in Italy is not because they wouldn't covet an SUV or they wouldn't drive an SUV. It's because driving SUVs in Italy would be really, really dumb. You couldn't fit down half the streets. You would not be able to find a place to park. You would be so inconvenienced by driving if you drove a large vehicle that the inconvenience that it already is would just be magnified.
So make it more inconvenient. Is that what you're saying?
If I'm running San Francisco, I'm having narrower streets. I'm having slower streets. I'm spending less money on asphalt and more money on bike walk infrastructure, trees, green space. And so, yeah, if I'm going to drive my big truck in downtown San Francisco, I'm going to find that like really, really inconvenient. That is the way if I was San Francisco, I would deal with it. That doesn't mean you won't get a big truck down there, but it's probably going to have to drive really, really slow and really, really careful. I wrote a blog post last year where I talked about we need to put in 1 billion bollards. Traffic engineers flip out. They hate bollards. Why? Because cars crash into them. Well, if you got a car driving 3 feet, 4 feet away from someone walking, you should have a bollard in between. And big trucks will likely hit those bollards. They will, but then they won't hit the people. And I have no problem with that. Like, I think that is actually a good outcome. People will drive slower. They will migrate to smaller vehicles. And I think that that would be like a glorious outcome of this. But it would be an outcome not through a regulatory process, which I think leaves dumb streets and dumb regulation. It would be an outcome through building great places.
What about speed limiters? I mean, we could make cars not able to go past the speed limit by more than 10 miles an hour.
Speed limiters seem like this magic amulet kind of thing that, and I'm going to stereotype here, but like progressive activists tend to love. Like, hey, can we get the federal government to step in and do this one like magic thing that will fix things? I'm going to say something that is true, and I want people to like marinate in it for a while. If you get hit by a car going 10 miles an hour over the speed limit in any neighborhood in America, you're going to be dead. So I realize like there's some victory in that the person on a 25 mile an hour street can only go 35 miles an hour and their car will like keep them from going faster than that. Fantastic. Like maybe that's a moral victory. It would come at a, like a really super high cost. I actually don't think we would get such legislation passed, but I'm not a politician. Maybe it would. But the reality is that if you paid that price and you paid that cost, I don't think it would have any impact on death rates because you get hit by someone going 35 miles an hour and you're dead. You get hit by someone, you know, the lowest speed limit street in my city is 30 miles an hour. So you could drive 40 miles an hour through every street. Well, most streets you can't get that fast because they've got bump outs and it's tight and you can't physically do it. I don't think that that actually solves anything.
But there are places, well, especially in cities, where it would make a difference because we do have multi-lane, one-way streets. If no cars are parked on it, it's five lanes.
Yeah, you have horribly designed streets. Yeah.
I agree. Right. But they seem allergic to change them. So something has to change, right?
Right. I always default to the idea that if I'm going to spend energy, if Strong Towns as an organization, if our thousands of members are going to spend energy, I want them to spend energy on stuff in front of their house, up the street from them, in their community that they can do. And that toolbox is really, really large. There's a lot of things that we can do right now. I want to spend energy on that instead of supporting a mayor who will support a legislator, who will support a president, who will appoint a commissioner, who will form a committee, who will someday like reform this and that. I feel like that is how we get manipulated. And I think that's how we get, that's how we waste decades of our lives and get nothing done. And not, no offense against people who work on that, like fine, go do that. But I'm not spending my energy on that. And I don't want to spend the energy of this movement on things like that. It's a distraction to me.
Just in reflecting upon the empathy, I understand that it is something that Strong Towns doesn't wish to spend money on. And believe me, if I could get that pill that you are, have seen administered in South Bend and you're advocating for, and I could give it to every city's leadership so that other towns could be this way, I'd want nothing more. It sounds wonderful. That's a place I want to be, and that's the type of things I would rather be spending time on. However, they aren't taking that and they aren't doing it with any speed, and the toll goes ever higher. So people will lash out in other directions when they see something that is a large problem. And is it okay if they do it? They still wish to fight that battle.
I feel like the most harmful myth that we have today, the one that separates us and keeps us from doing productive things in this space, in the bike walk advocacy space, is the myth that 94% of crashes are caused by driver error. When there's a crash, we send the police out and they have a checklist of things. What caused this crash? Was the person speeding? Were they wearing a seatbelt? Were they intoxicated? And we've reduced the cause of crashes down to like half a dozen different things. At Strong Towns, we created this thing called the Crash Analysis Studio, where we look at crashes and we analyze them and we look at the multiple factors that cause them. And what we find in every single one that we've ever looked at is that, yes, sometimes drivers make mistakes, but drivers are making mistakes in an environment that itself like breeds mistakes, creates mistakes. The empathy that I think we need to show is not empathy for the driver who's a jerk, who pulls up next to you and revs their engine and rides real close and yells at the window. That person is acting like a horrible person, and I'm not asking you to have empathy for them. But I do think that if we step back and look, there, every single family in America, every single one, has had someone who has died in a car crash, knows someone close to them who has died in a car crash, knows someone who's been a traumatic injury in a car, has suffered a traumatic injury themselves. And the idea that that death, that violence would be reduced to some driver effed up, some driver made a mistake, as opposed to the environments that we built is violent and nasty and dehumanizing and was the primary cause of this crash, if we want to mock somebody, if we want to raise awareness, that's what we need to raise awareness of, is that the humans that we put into cars are entering spaces that are designed to be deadly. And my God, I feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for their families. I feel sorry for their loved ones. I feel sorry for the people on bikes that are tormented and hit. And I feel sorry for the people biking and walking. We all share in this trauma, and we can all actually do something about it tomorrow, today, in our own cities, if we're motivated by it. So I would like to see the bike walk advocates attack that 94% number more than I want to see them shame drivers or, you know, run to the NTSB or empower some federal agency. Let's clearly like talk to each other about the fact that crashes are not driver, they're not caused by driver error. Driver error might be a contributing factor, but crashes are caused by poorly built, dangerous environments that we all live in.
I look forward to dicing this up and playing it for the SFMTA board in 2-minute increments that I'm allotted during public comment, so that maybe some of this will get in there.
Well, maybe sometime when I come to San Francisco, we can go do that together. We can show up and I'll do my 2 minutes and you can do yours, and we'll let them know we're here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there a way to get in touch with Strong Towns? Do you have chapters?
Absolutely. Well, if you go to strongtowns.org/local, you'll see our local conversations. We have 200 of them across the country. I'm sure we have one in the Bay Area, but I can't promise you. I know we have a lot in California. So yeah, check that out. And strongtowns.org. I mean, all of our stuff is Creative Commons licensed, so it's free to use, free to share. You don't even have to attribute it to us. Just go out and do good things in the world.
Ryan.
Thank you.
Thanks, Charles.
Thanks so much. You bet.